A word to the wise. We are an explicit podcast tackling content with adult themes as well as entering spoiler territory if you aren't caught up with us. That would be through the entirety of Best Served Cold by Joe Abercrombie.
Hey there, this is Cross.
And I am PJ.
And we are Words and Whiskey, a podcast for veteran and novice readers alike. We tackle fiction novels and love to talk about what we're drinking. You should think of us as your intoxicating weekly tea club. I'm book club.
We have a quorum in tea today, but I do not have tea because we have a third person on the microphone today. Leanna, hi.
I was like, do I talk now?
Hi. Yeah, you can say whatever you'd like.
And instead of just lurking, like, I'm also here, but yeah. I'm just listening.
Yep. I'm just listening to this weird banter.
Just creepily in the room.
I didn't get the memo that you guys were all making tea, so.
Well, it's 1 p.m. on a Sunday.
Right. It's a reasonable response. It was my brother's birthday yesterday, and I absolutely was, like, losing my voice this morning. So I was like, I've been slamming tea all morning in an attempt to make sure that I can talk, so.
I was sick at the beginning. I got sick on New Year's. And so, like, I'm fine now. But really cold drinks, like icy drinks, still make me, like, cough a little bit. So figured that would be a bad idea for an audio recording.
Totally, totally fair. So, like PJ said earlier, today is our wrap-up episode talking about Best Served Cold. We're very excited, of course, to be joined by Leanna here. And, we're gonna chat about my favorite book that I've read in my adult life, which is the longest string of qualifiers, but also my favorite first law book, and hopefully some other people's. It's up there, you know. I don't know. Woo,
boo.
It used to be my favorite. It isn't anymore.
That's fair.
What?
There's something to be said about the last trilogy.
Did it get superseded by one that came out later, or was it upon reflection that changed?
It's a combination. I think the new trilogy blew this out of the water, but I also think that some of the books in the first law, the first time through, were not immediately my favorites, but rereading them 3, 4, 10 times, they grow on me. And then this one, like, the opposite happened. Like, I don't hate it now, but it's less fun to reread. The first time through, I was like, whoa, that was the best one. Oh my God. But now, like, the sleeper favorites are, like, overtaking it. So, like, before they were hanged, I didn't like that much the first time. The heroes, I didn't like that much the first time. And now, I just, rereading them multiple times, they kind of have grown on me a lot more. And Best Served Cold has lost its shine. So.
Okay. Gotcha.
How dare you? B, totally get it.
Talk to me from a few years ago and I'd been all about it.
Yeah, fair. Totally, totally get that. One of the things that I love about this story, and one of the things that just kind of stands out to me, of course, is sort of its function and its structure. And part of the reason that I think it stands out that way is because it does feel kind of episodic in a lot of ways, and that breaks it up into a nice and interesting pace. What was your guys' favorite section of the episodes of Monza Mercado's Journey of Pointless Revenge?
Favorite in terms of what?
Like, which part? I mean, just in general, like, maybe, like, the sort of heisty element of most of them, or, like, the, I don't know, there's like, a little bit of Guy Ritchie tucked in each of these that I kind of, like, in my head, you know, kind of like. So, for me, it's Sapani. I love the whole sequence that happens in Cardotti's and, like, the kind of setup leading up to it, you know, reintroducing ourselves to Casca and that whole, like, so that part stands out in my head as one of my favorites.
I think for me, the comedy of errors leading to the killing of Malthus.
That's fair.
Yeah,
that's
good. That was a lot
right
of fun.
Off the bat.
I don't know if I have a favorite because they kind of build on each other and build on, I don't want to say long running jokes because it's a pretty dark book, but the interactions between this horrible crew, the way that their ability to get along with each other or the lack thereof mounts and morphs is kind of what makes each one. They, like, I don't think they stand on their own that much. They kind of build from the previous ones.
Sure.
So I feel like the reason why a later one works so well is because of how it like built on the previous misunderstandings and previous rufflings and mismatches from before, and the irritations and assumptions that have grown over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the friction of the group as they continue to, you know, interact and push against each other. I'm definitely with you. I just even think from like a sequential standpoint of like as an inventive idea that Joe is presenting to us. I mean, it's hard to also say like the fight with Ganmark is maybe the most impressive of the like, I don't know, like sort of action sequences, I think, in the book as well. But it's like something about Sapani just screams, I don't know, like eminently adaptable to me. And so that's kind of why I pictured that one so clearly in my head.
Well, one of like Abercrombie's favorite things to do, and he obviously does it in this book as well, is to consciously echo and repeat and call back to previous either characters or previous situations or whatever. And I mean, I know that Monza is the main character of this book, but this is Shivers' book. So right. The parts of Shivers I do like the best. And the way that we play with a lot of other narratives in First Law through Shivers, so the way Shivers both repeats, like both echoes and contrasts with Logan Ninefingers, and then the way his own arc like folds in on itself, where like he has this whole revenge against his brother, or a revenge against the killer of his brother, which is Logan Ninefingers. And then he decides against that, right? So First Law ends and he's not going to do revenge. He's decided not to do it. He's going to be a better man. And then comes Monza and is like, I want revenge for the killing of my brother. And he's like, is that a sign that I'm supposed to be doing this? And then later he, like the Northman that they're hiring to go to Cardati's, and he's like, oh, we're going to pretend. And I'm going to pretend to be Logan Ninefingers, the guy that killed my brother. And he's like, oh, that's so messed up. But then another layer is that the guy he's fighting is going to kill Shivers because Shivers killed his brother. And like the way that just like mounts and mounts and mounts and like folds in on itself to, or it's a parody of itself almost. Like truly revenge is the, what is it they always say? Is that like when you, isn't there an old saying about how if you decide to take revenge, you should dig two graves, one for them and one for yourself?
Yeah. It is such a great like echoing theme throughout. I particularly like it, especially as you also consider like Shivers and Monza's sort of inversion as you go through the story, right? In sort of like the negative cold and then coming out on the other side like wishing to be a better person and like striving for that, versus Shivers walking in striving to be a better person then walking out hardened and damaged.
And on top of all the complications that you already mentioned with Logan Ninefingers, I don't know why I put the inflection like that.
not the other Ninefingers.
the complications internally with Logan and how he's constantly, anytime he references him to Monza, he's referring to him as a wise man or as something positive. He very rarely negatively speaks about Logan externally.
Well, yeah. Even in his internal monologue.
Like, that's true too. Yeah.
I mean, that was kind of the, I don't want to say like a twist reveal, but it's almost like a twist reveal when the whole time in First Law, we have this looming shadow of Shivers wanting revenge and everyone knowing he does and knowing why, and Logan knowing it as well. And then it comes down to it and Shivers is like, I'm just supposed to want that because this is where I am in our society and that's what society expects. And the facts of the matter are the killer of my brother is someone I should want to kill, but I don't actually want to kill you. Not for me, not for him. I just am doing it because I'm supposed to want to. So he's like, what if I just didn't though?
Exactly.
Yeah, what if I just passed on that opportunity? Which is such a fun thing. I mean, since the last time we spoke with you, we've obviously read this in Last Argument, so PJ finally got pulled through the ringer of the end of the story. And I remember PJ's genuine shock, because I think you had made a bet that Shivers was going to kill him in the end, or something to that point.
Hope you don't.
Having sort of the inversion.
I think I bet that
we bet drinks,
try.
So yeah.
Yeah.
But also, we get this in First Law, and then it's also, they repeat it here in case you forgot the whole, he got his name, Shivers, you know, and he keeps telling people it's always because people shiver in fear. And the way that so many things in First Law, if you repeat a thing enough, it comes true. That, like, you are who you pretend to be, which is actually a quote from The Name of the Wind. But, like, the fact that he's been saying that for since the beginning, but by the end of Best Served Cold, it, like, a prophecy, it has come true. That is even if it's not why his name is originally Shivers, it is now.
Yeah, I think that's very poetic. Everything about this book is very poetic, this series.
It's one of the things, too, in which this is the first book, obviously, outside of this, and I feel like this was the first time that Joe really got to flex independent storytelling muscles, which is one of the reasons that I also really like it, is it feels like a departure in a lot of ways from the previous story in terms of like needing to build up to this big epic climactic sort of moment or series of moments and kind of like tie everything together. This is allowed to kind of be its own isolated storytelling, focused character driven moments, and kind of like dialing in there while still containing sort of some of the larger beats and undertones where we still get the tie-ins indirectly to like Baez and Ishri and Gurkle and sort of the whole thing going on in the background and the presentation of Shanked, Mr. Casimir. Lana, do you think that he's Mr. King Casimir from the past? Are you of an opinion?
No, I mean, I don't think about it.
Fair.
That's fair.
Fair enough. I'd say we were a bit fixated on it as we were going through. PJ,
I was very much fixated on it.
I tend not to think that way at all when I read First Law or anything by Joe Abercrombie, just because I know how little he cares about that kind of aspect of world building, that if that ended up being the case, it's as likely as not, it's because the story kind of could be that way. And later on, he's like, I could make it be that, sure. But was it originally that? No. He just was like, it works, so I decided to use it.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Because of the little point of leverage.
Like, I don't think he intended when he first wrote Young Shivers, who is called that because he was shivering, and he's telling people that, no, it's because people shiver in fear when they see me. I don't think when he wrote that he was like, ah, but I'm going to write a standalone, and by the end of that standalone, people truly will shiver in fear at the name. I mean, like, that came later. Mm-hmm. He was like, oh, what if I like made it come true?
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Speaking of Shanks, though, is he our only magic proprietor within the story? I think.
Well, there's always
Ishri.
Ishri's there.
Yeah. And Yoru.
Yoru's there, but I don't think he ever really does anything magical.
Just his presence is ominous.
That's fair. Yeah. That's a good point. He does
his head
over Monza with sharp
teeth. I was like, anytime someone's like, oh, he's got two different color eyes, you're like, oh, where's Baez? It's happening.
That's true.
And there's already a knife in my back. Yeah.
Or anytime someone says Voldemort, I mean, Valentin Balk.
Yeah. Very, very true. Valentin Balk is always like that terrifying kind of force in the background of the story, which is why I think the end also works so well in that final confrontation, where it's like very clearly Valentin Balk. And then there's almost this hunger that Yoru has in that moment before Shanks shows up and kind of dissuades in the same way that they apparently had Ishri the day before. So good. I love this sort of third force aspect.
Well, and we have that sort of the Greek tragedy element of people fitting into roles, whether they wanted to or not, the way that Shivers was trying to escape this destiny of being a man of violence, and it's an inescapable destiny. His name becomes his destiny. And the way Monza, she took a tumble and to the best of her ability was not trying to usurp or so, but Shank's plan was for her to do that, and Benna's plan was for her to do that. And by the end, she did do that. Because even though that wasn't what she was really trying to do, that was her destiny. And so it came true. Poisoners always die by their own agents. It's a prophecy.
That's true, too.
You can't escape your destiny.
I did. I loved the sort of, I don't think it's wordplay, but the play on the crown being poison.
Oh, yeah.
As Morvir put that contact poison on it.
Yeah, those that seek power and power being poison. It's a great little bit of,
and Monza being the only one not truly wanting it and being the only one wearing
heavy as the head that wears the crown or whatever.
Yeah. What was it, PJ, you said the other day, just kind of summing up the Shivers thing, we've started the heroes for the record at this point, so PJ's a little bit in on that one, just barely the first section.
Four
chapters. It was nominative
determinism.
Four or five chapters. Yes, and sort of how a lot of the Northmen kind of feel that way, one way or another, be it at the beginning or at the end of their arcs, right? And how they own who they are.
Crossan, you got to stop talking into your cups.
I'm so sorry.
You've done
first like time recording a
my
podcast.
Voice at a consistent volume. Yeah.
It's okay, you're a rookie.
I just like the little echo it makes.
Oh man. Yeah, I think that's a good example of Shivers, as I talked about in the upcoming episode that hasn't been released yet. But
oops.
The idea of sort of growing into the name that you're given, that's very much on display with Shivers by the end of this book, as has already been discussed a little bit.
Yeah. But then also, I think Monza falls into kind of that same camp, like we were saying, like the Snake of Talons then becoming sort of in charge of and the leader of inadvertently, despite not wanting that, and the whole setup with Benna. Also, like, fuck Benna. Do we all
literally
universally? No. Leave that for Monza.
Yeah,
I love Shivers being like, oh, oh no.
Yeah, there's yeah. some. I wouldn't have expected it to be such a huge scandal, considering everything else that goes on within this world, but everybody seems pretty detestable to basically everybody.
Well, knowing that Joe is such a huge fan of A Song of Ice and Fire, I wonder if he threw that in there as a nod to the Lannisters.
Yeah.
I think so. I think it makes sense. Mm-hmm. And then it's also like a secret kind of backdoor thing, and Orso just takes willing tools, you know, as sort of a part of his primary characteristic, and so they fit right into the tool chest alongside Ganmark in that case. It's like disguised progressivism too, which I think is interesting, you know, in and amongst like him and Orso himself, but I think that works well.
Benna was useless. She was better off without him.
True.
Yeah, but he... True. I loved how at every step we did get more and more of the reality of Benna that Casca kind of spits out right at the beginning of Benna being the true orchestrator of all of it. And I was trying to figure out why the whole time. Like, why does he hate Benna so much? And then as we go through it, more and more opens up, and that was a
also like
reveal.
The flashbacks to like Papa Casca. He's like, oh, mm-hmm, kids, mm-hmm, I'll teach you to read. Like, it's like, yeah. Aw.
Absolutely adorable. My favorite Styrian, definitely, but I was glad. I'm always glad to see the favorite Styrian return. And it's one of those where it's like, I've been waiting for this, even when we were talking about it and before they're hanged, and like just his inclusion. I was like, oh, I want to get to real Casca. Let's get to the, oh man. My God,
I'm ashamed by how much I really hope anytime someone overhears me that they're familiar with First Law, which is unlikely, that I'll be like, a drink.
I should start.
That's a great one. I definitely
start
picking like, a mug with that on it. In an unfortunate, ironic standpoint.
His mustaches are a character unto themselves.
True.
You know what? They should have Kenneth Branagh play Nikomokov.
See, so that's what mustache. I was. Oh my god, with the Poro. Yeah, that'd be great. That's such an intense mustache too. Like, mm-hmm, in
ridiculous
in comparison. PJ, you've seen at least one of the Poro movies, haven't you? The Murder on the Orient. Really?
I don't think so.
You're not missing
fired.
Much.
Yeah.
Go watch the David.
He's missing
Suchet
the
one.
Mustache. Yeah. With that said, I mean, since we're in and among the rest of casting, obviously, compared to the rest of this has actually been like optioned out as an adaptation, various small attachments here and there. No like higher level notes in the last couple of years, basically. Nothing too crazy. So no promises. But who do we think outside of Monza, whom has been cast, or maybe?
But do we agree with the casting
well?
Of Monza?
I take it you don't, and I think we actually
talked
about
this. I think she's a good actress, but she's not at all like what I would imagine or cast to play Monza. Like, I'm sure she can pull it off, but it's going to be really different from the Monza in the book.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it'll be. I think she'll pull it off well, but I notoriously do not have a good like eye for things as far as like descriptions go and holding imagery in my head. So whatever happens is going to become the way that it is for me.
Yeah, I think the thing riding against Rebecca Ferguson is like her age relative to Monza's, I think, is maybe the biggest thing at whatever point we actually get it compared to that in the story. Not that that's ultimately that
her
big of a note
age,
within the context of the story.
Also how like fair and delicate she looks, which she's a really beautiful woman. But Monza is described as being very kind of Mediterranean and dark, like dark hair, dark eyes, and, you know, obviously being younger. But even an older woman, you know, she's just not described as looking remotely like Rebecca Ferguson.
Fair. Yes. Definitely fair. Yeah. Rebecca Ferguson does look more like the person on the cover of the American version than as depicted in the pages, which is...
Rebecca Ferguson looks more like she could play Therese.
True.
That's true.
And sharp enough to do it, too.
Which, to bring it back to my Served Cold, the story, I do like, I think he strikes the balance of just putting in enough, but not too much, of nods to stuff from First Law. So, like, the brief glimpse we get of Therese and Giselle. And when they mention old sticks, you know, but we don't really see him, but we have him mentioned. And we reference things that happened in the trilogy. I think it's enough for anyone that's read it to kind of be like, oh, that was that thing right there. But not enough to be... I mean, it is supposed to be a standalone, so it's not so much that if you'd never read First Law, that you'd be reading this going, I don't understand anything that's happening. It's just these like little moments.
I am really curious how many people have read this book before reading First Law.
I think quite a lot.
Think so?
Yeah.
I had
a lot of
that
people
in my brain
don't
throughout.
Want to like... Because a lot of people don't really want to dive into a trilogy because that's a bigger commitment. And then also because there's so many people that are like, oh, First Law trilogy, it's so like meandering and it feels like it's not going anywhere. So then people who are put off by that or not know if they really want to commit to this, they'll read Best Served Cold.
Okay. I had that in my brain while reading this. Like, what would somebody that doesn't know the first trilogy think of all of this? And like that popped up all the time, and I think for the most part it'd be perfectly fine. I think this would be a very reasonable entrance into the universe,
but the benefit too, I think, because some people read the new trilogy first, which I know you haven't read, but the new trilogy is something that if you read that first, you obviously can go back and read, but it does spoil a lot of things that if you went back to read the first books, they would be kind of ruined for you because now you know a lot. Whereas Best Served Cold really doesn't tell you much that would ruin the original trilogy. It doesn't, when it nods to things, it nods to them. So it doesn't, there's a few characters that you're like, well, they must survive because they're in this, but there isn't like a big giveaway of like how First Law ends.
Right. And Giselle isn't, none of the characters that are hinted at are ever named, I believe. So nobody would know that Giselle would be king.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think they ever say Glockta's name. I think they just say Old Sticks.
Yeah, or the
Which
cripple.
I think anyone would immediately or guess that's Glockta. But you wouldn't take a genius to put that together. But
That was one point, though, is going back to the idea of adaptation, how to approach the scene between Monza and Giselle without giving away the fact that Giselle becomes king of the Union.
You mean in an adaptation?
Yep. Yeah. Sorry.
I mean, this is a bit of a ways on, so I would imagine if they went back and adapted the first three, you have to have quite a young man playing Giselle. So hopefully they would cast somebody else to play him, or... I mean, that's why I kind of don't like the idea of adapting this first. I get why a studio would do that. For the same reason that people read it first instead of the trilogy is because it's a lower commitment. But it does kind of spoil things.
Right.
In that way.
It's one of those small details that in the rest of it, it's like, well, you can kind of get away with it because he's going to be behind a mask and you can like play around with like perspective and angles to like see the camera like through the peephole that's kind of going on in the room at the time from Day and from Warvir's perspective as they're kind of looking between the couple of rooms, and like you can play with it so that it doesn't need to be more than it is, but also it would be nice to have some like continuity or congruity between, you know, the segments of the story. But that said, it's all risk aversion with starting with Best Served Cold first in the first place. There's even some I've read a lot of people speculating that maybe they would even like shift this backward in time, but I don't like that either because I feel like you would lose Shivers. The growth therein.
I would be genuinely really angry about it. I feel like Joe Abercrombie would be pretty against that.
Joe wouldn't do that. Yeah.
especially because like Shivers continues to be important for like the rest of the books. So it's a character you don't really want to start this whole project by ruining. It's a bad idea.
Yeah, he's the weird one that you'd have to like recast, though, more so, you know, than like someone like Jizal, even, because like you then have to step back in time for the trilogy when he comes in and before they're hanged, and then kind of walk forward from there.
Yeah, which, but I mean, I think with, well, with Rebecca Ferguson, I think they would be casting a considerably older Shivers, which also doesn't really work for this story because he needs to be pretty young still and old enough to be a man that's a man of violence and is a reasonable threat. But young enough to where he can sort of be like, I want to be a better person naively. Like, I'm finally sort of breaking out into the world myself, and I'm getting these rose-tinted glasses that I've decidedly put on despite evidence to the contrary. I love what, like, the introduction, like, when he first shows up and he's, like, been told that this is the land of opportunity and there's just jobs and food and everything's so great. And he's like, yeah, I'm not finding that to be the case. like the first bit of food he buys, like the price is like as much as a whole animal in the north, and it's just gristle. And he's like, I'm not even surprised. It's like, to me, it was like the first law version of the first time someone buys a churro at Disneyland and they're like, it's $20 and it's cold. It's not even wow.
Yeah, that's disappointing. He had the instinct right away to just turn around and go home.
And when he's like, you know, that friend of mine that maybe I shouldn't think of as a friend who was like, oh, that's such a great place. And he's like, maybe I should have wondered why, if it's so great, why aren't they there?
Why isn't Vossela here? Yeah. Why'd he leave and go to the north? That doesn't make any sense. If it's this great land of opportunity. What a great like mid-book or even it's early on, frankly, and then it continues to grow in his resentment towards the guy. But then I think in the end he comes around being like, I kind of need to like pat Vossela on the back for what he did to me to reveal who I am. And that's like, your pat on the back now, Shiver, sounds like you're going to kill him. So it's
mess with Shivers.
It's not a good pat on the back to have.
Not a pleasant person to have in your corner.
The irony of Monza being put off by Shiver's scars and disfigurement when she was the first to be disfigured, the hypocrisy of it, and the fact that she's self-aware enough to know it's hypocritical, but she's like, I can't help it. He looks gross to me now. She's like, I am into the ones that look like Benna. The pretty boys.
Looking for people that look like my brother, but and then even like dressing him up and cutting his hair and everything like that. I realize that we've been like talking about characters and not talking around them. How do we feel about Monza? Do we like Monza in the end of the story as much as we might like any First Law character? You know, like we said earlier, it's Monza's book, but it's really Shivers. But how do we feel about Monza in the end?
I don't think I've put a lot of thought into this.
I feel like she's both less bad and more bad than you think at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she is simultaneously a like victim of circumstance and kind of evil. I don't know.
I feel like she's the, like, do you guys ever listen to Behind the Bastards podcast?
Yeah.
I have not.
So for anyone that hasn't, on that podcast, they'll do a deep dive on the bastard that they're choosing to cover, and it'll be someone, or, you know, a real human being, but they'll do a dive on their backstory, their childhood, how they got to be where they were. And if it's a multi-parter, the first episode will often have you feeling quite sympathetic towards this person that you know, because you already know they're a famous person, a famous bastard. You already know what it is they're supposed to have done and how they end up being really, really bad. But when they do the beginning part about their childhood and about what they went through or what traumas they had or whatever, you're like, wow, like poor them. And, you know, it's not that it justifies what they later do, but unfortunately, it kind of makes sense that that's kind of where they ended up. And so that's, I think, if Monza was a real person and Behind the Bastards was covering her, they'd be like, well, there's these childhood episodes where, like, you know, you kind of see how she was kind of, you know, never going to be anything but what she ended up being. And
Yeah.
I love the flashbacks for that reason, because it does color in the rest of the context. And it's like, oh, well, I get why you're this way. I totally understand, like, why you picked up a sword and then, like, wait, Ben is like leading you into the rest of this, and then, okay, hang on, should I really blame you for like how you are, the way that you are? But also, you went along with it for so long. So I think that they would definitely give her the stamp of bastard without a doubt in my mind.
But it's interesting
Oprah
how both...
Oprah Winfrey, maybe not, but...
Both her and Shivers found that trying to live an honest life, it just wasn't very profitable. And when you're good at violence, you know, they say you should do what you're good at, right? So mm-hmm. lean into your skills. And both of them decided to lean in.
Yeah,
lots of stabbing, you know, for both of them in different contexts. Yeah, I love Monza. I've always found the sort of accusation that gets leveled at her that feels like a masculine female character, or like a masculine perspective guised in females' clothes, to be a little off. But then at the same time, I think that the more that I've read it and repeated, I can kind of see it more or less. Like, but also there's just a variety of different people, you know, that like make up any diaspora. So I don't know. Did either of you pick up on that in particular in this read? I mean, I know we talked a lot last time about like Artie and sort of underwriting in Joe's female characters, but
I mean, I think she has a lot more masculine tendencies, but not in a way that's like okay, some women are more masculine in their interests and their attitudes, and some are more feminine, whatever that actually means, how we define that. So in terms of mm-hmm. her choice of career, choice of occupation, the whole if you're gonna control men of violence, you have to be feared by men of violence. So there's no being a soft female. And she oftentimes reflects on, Benna gets to smile, Benna gets to be nice. I don't have that luxury. So mm-hmm. in often throughout, I wouldn't say it's like, oh, this is a male writer that doesn't know how to write a strong female. He just writes a man that has boobs. I don't feel like that's the case. I feel like that's a really mm-hmm. reductive reading of this. She's a woman that has been carved into the shape she is by the world that she's in. And it's a quite realistic depiction of what a woman in those circumstances, how she would think and operate.
Right. How she's been forced to be, you know, in part because she wants to protect her brother, and in part because, like, this was the easy way and the things that she was good at. So she continued to pursue them, right? Like, I think that's one of the things, is she did have an off-ramp at a couple of different points in her life where she didn't have to continue doing this. She didn't have to chase down being a mercenary after they got their first taste of revenge, but turns out it just paid a lot better than farming.
Yeah.
A lot better.
I think I would push back a little bit on your call out of it being partially to do with taking care of her brother. I think it's entirely. I think every single breath that she takes up until his death was in service of protecting him. And
well, after his death, it's all about vengeance for him. It's yeah, still about
exactly.
him.
It's still about him after his death. But I think that was the overtone of her entire life from the time her father died onward. Even before that, I think, like, she was kind of his primary caretaker as the sick boy.
And her father is even like, hey, you got to take care of him. You need to plant the seed for the harvest or you'll starve, and you need to take care of your brother. And she's mm-hmm. like, oh, I will take care of him. Don't you worry.
Yeah, reap what you sow, I guess, or something.
But it is also, I mean, I think there could be an interesting reading of it, because we don't actually get Benna's perspective. We don't really know much about how right. he feels about any of this. And a case could be made that Benna was abused and groomed, because, like, she's the older mm-hmm. sister, and the fact that they end up together, you're like, I mean, maybe it was totally consensual, but he's the younger brother, the brother that everyone keeps saying is the one that's the follower, the one that's not strong. And the fact that, like, if this was the other way around, I think everyone would immediately read it. If she was a man and Benna was a girl and we found out they were sleeping together, we'd be like, oh, this is an abusive older brother that was, like, you know, sexually abusing his younger sister. But because she's a woman and because it's a younger brother, then we're like, oh, it's incest. But it's like, I mean, it definitely is incest, but, like,
right.
why is she get off the hook for this?
That's a good call.
Yeah. Good point on the like grooming angle there.
She raised him essentially after their father died.
Did she raise him to be the evil bastard that he is? You know, like,
she and Costa.
Obviously he's got some of that. Yeah, right, exactly. You know, and whoever was the bookkeeper, right, at the time, was it Sejan that was the bookkeeper? Anyway, was like the primary one teaching Benna throughout kind of the side course of the story. So yeah, maybe she maybe he's also a seed that she sowed that she then reaped the consequences of. Oh, Monza. What about tertiary characters? What about our friendlies, our obviously our Koskas, our Morvirs, our Days of the world?
How is Friendly a tertiary character when he's a perspective?
You understand.
He's not
what I
Monza
mean.
Or Shivers.
Secondary. Yeah.
Oh, I love
he's
Friendly.
So good at counting.
Are we
saying that Friendly so counts? He's not a tertiary character. He counts.
Yeah, he counts. Good one.
Oh.
We've got again.
We have got again. Friendly was by far and away my favorite perspective, my favorite character.
I
think my favorite character of the series so far. I really, really enjoyed
it. He's a simple man with simple desires.
Exactly. That's it. And a whole lot of violence.
I think it was the last time that we'd spoken. We had talked about the wrap up, and I was like, I know PJ's favorite character is in Best Served Cold, and I know that it's Friendly. I know he'll just love him from that moment, and I was not disappointed.
Friendly by himself isn't that great to me, but I love watching Friendly and Koska together.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the way their friendship develops and blossoms over the course of the story is one of my favorite moments. It just like reminds us that Koska does have a heart, I think, which can be lost in among the rest of sort of the noise of being a mercenary leader and sort of his various foibles and stances and philosophizing about whatever in so many different contexts. And it's just like this reminder that he's got like a really deep, he's a caring guy. I mean,
Within the context of like where they are, who they are, what their jobs are, he does genuinely take in Monza and Benna and try to do right by them in, you know, whatever way he's able. Like it's not nefarious, like him taking them in. They do owe a lot to Koska, and it does feel really horrible when you learn how, when he tells the story very flippantly of how like, yeah, we decided to pretend to go separate ways and pretend to fight each other, and it was a really good gig we had going until one of us decided not to pretend anymore, and yeah, that really sucked. You're like, oh, that is brutal. And then he recalls, you know, charging in kind of drunk because we're doing it again, and then he's like, oh fuck, like we are not pretending. Oh my god. And like what a gut punch that is. And like, we're talking about mercenaries, so it's like, I mean, how much sympathy can you have? But also, you're like, but interpersonally, he took them in, they trust each other, he raised them, basically. Like, that's a pretty brutal stab in the back. That's not just like, you know, taking over the business. That's really bad.
I don't read it this way, but I think someone could read Koska as strictly opportunistic and recognizing the people that he cares about as being valuable to him, because that seems to kind of be the case for the most part, with Benna and Monza kind of pulling off all of these great, great leadership roles, which he kind of ushered them into and trained them to be, which is like he raised them into it, which is why I don't necessarily full-heartedly believe what I'm saying right now. There's also the case for Friendly, where everything, like their entire friendship is based upon Friendly kind of doing stuff for Koska, but Friendly loves doing, like it's things that Friendly really enjoys doing anyway. So I don't think that's necessarily a nefarious thing.
He's finding a space for him, you know.
Yeah, like it's a symbiotic relationship.
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah. Koska gets someone to talk at, and Friendly has things to count. And that's important for both of them.
It's important.
It's like there's a meme that like introverts don't get friends. They just get adopted by extroverts. I feel like Friendly just got adopted by Koska.
Yeah, a little bit.
That is pretty true. Yeah. He definitely did just get kind of like roped in. And he's so good. He's so useful. You could do so
like
much.
That, like first chat they have when Koska's like, man, I just love the way Friendly's confident enough and cool enough to just be quiet, not say anything, and not care what anyone thinks. And the narrator's like, now this didn't stop Koska from talking. he was blah, 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 blah. I love the way this guy doesn't say anything. So anyway, as I was saying.
Yeah, talking at him, right? Like the repeated refrain. Yeah, I love their relationship. I appreciate the fact that like Friendly is in many ways like a bit character comparatively, but at the same time, simultaneously is like such a unique perspective and a wonderful little spice that gets sprinkled into the rest of this book.
He's uniquely uncomplicated.
Yeah, yeah. True. Yeah.
Everyone else is a mess.
Very true. I find his end so sad when he wants to go back to prison.
He's happy.
Gets the letter.
He's so happy. I know. Why is that? He's the only one gets a happy ending. Yeah.
Well, not even because he got disappointed because he didn't get to go. Like that's why I feel sad. It's okay, like this tragedy of like I don't get my I can never have that ever again.
I love his reflection on how he got in trouble when he was given the job of serving food in the prison because he would count every single bean to make sure everyone's portion was equal, and this pissed people off. He's just like, yeah. I don't understand the problem.
Everybody gets 28 beans. That'd be it. That's, is 28 beans a nutritious enough meal for
sampling of beans?
A prison.
For prisoners?
Population. Yeah.
For your baby, no. Just keep that in mind.
We gotta feed them.
Maybe don't
beans.
Give your baby any beans.
Yeah.
Infants are supposed to eat beans.
Probably. Infants probably can't have beans. I should figure that out. We'll get a bean equivalent of breast milk or formula or whatever.
Count every drop, count precisely.
You're gonna have
She'll
to figure
appreciate
that out. Yeah. No way Caitlin's helping with that.
Nope.
So many of Friendly's like little flashbacks too, and like the Joe cleverly weaving in like commentary or not commentary, but like just the idea of the different legal systems within this and like just the idea of jail and the way that we punish people variously across societies and the conflict that immediately happens between Shivers and him being like, that sounds awful. Like that is the worst. And it's like, well, you literally just generally kill them if they do something bad. So like, that's also awful. Like you're just retaining. It's such an interesting juxtaposition from their perspectives interrogating that. Damn it. I almost talked into my cup again.
But you didn't. Almost. And that's what matters.
I caught it.
But also I think a thing that he does cleverly and Friendly is a good example of it is for every perspective that Joe writes, he's able to both write from the perspective of that character while also not holding the perspective of that character. So like, no, mm-hmm. like the reading from Friendly's perspective, Friendly is thinking in a way that makes sense to Friendly. He's not stepping out of his character to make sense of this for you. But the narrator of the book, like the author, isn't writing in a way that, do you know what I mean? Like, and he does that with Friendly. It's like, it's kind of this gimmick because the way Friendly thinks is so bizarre. But mm-hmm. he does this with other characters as well, like with Giselle in The First Law and the way he thinks of women. Giselle thinks of women this way, and Giselle doesn't like comment on his own perspective. Like he's thinking pretty terrible things about women. But the narrator of the story is both showing you how this person thinks and not changing it while also making it clear that this is what they think.
Yeah, I mean, and you can see that in the way that different characters like are actually like peering off in their own ways, right? It keeps that characterization or they're like, Even if you look at Friendly from the outside, from someone like Koska or Shiver's perspective, you can generally see him suddenly fixating on something and you're like, oh, okay, so he's
when counting, Monza he's is like, is versus... are you counting right now? Like, what are you doing? Meanwhile, Friendly's like, I wish you'd stop talking because I'm really enjoying counting. And
yeah, there's so many people.
Getting a massive hard on for this, or because he's watching Day when Day is counting as they're the windows or whatever outside, and he's getting mm-hmm. such a hard on, like watching and listening to her count. He's like, so you can just leave him alone so he can enjoy this glorious moment. Like it's creepy, but
what a yeah.
So good.
Yeah. Friendly is delightfully creepy, I would say.
Yeah, but I want to go into that sort of commentary on the perspective and the character versus the narrator. It's I know there are other examples of that and other authors do it very well too, but for whatever reason I feel like Joe very uniquely blends the character's voice into the narration of their part. Also, like it's this weird blend of both. It's not narrated by the character, but it's narrated in their voice at the same time.
It's not just the dialogue, but like when you're in Shiver's perspective, there's like grammatically incorrect sentences because they're part of the dialect that Shivers has. And it's not even italicized thoughts. It's not dialogue. Mm-hmm. It's just the narration, the third person narration, where it'll say, you know, like weren't instead of wasn't, because that's how Shivers would talk. But it's not actually Shivers talking. It's just his chapter.
Right, exactly. It feels unique, and maybe it's not. I'm not that well read, but it feels very cool.
I mean, there's a reason I think people say Joe. Yeah, Joe is known for being a good character writer. That's part of it.
Yeah, it's a newer. I was just reading. I reread Consider This the other day again, and it was something that Chuck Palahniuk brought up, where it's like this new third person perspective that is so tight to the shoulder that it does feel like first person in a lot of ways, and that's one of the things that I think that Joe was definitely on, or rather has been like. One example of a popularist author of whom has absolutely nailed that. Wow, get that sentence out. Of whom has absolutely nailed that sort of tone and like bringing us really into the shoes without dropping us into the literal I's and B's of the text.
And beans?
Me's? But yeah, beans. All the beans, okay. For sure. Mm-hmm. 28 beans, precisely.
Drop me in the beans.
No more, no less. Speaking of creepy, though, Morvir, how do we feel about Morvir?
He's also creepy. The way he thinks about his mother.
The way he thinks about almost anybody.
Just especially his mother.
But his...
Very Oedipal.
His mother, whom he poisoned.
It's not his fault. Everyone that he allows to get close, you know, they just... They screw him over. What is a poor man to do? Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
It pains him to do it, but nobody understands.
Yeah. Truly, like the pained artist.
He's just so unappreciated.
Yeah. No one gets me. And in some ways, I kind of feel like Morvir also gets a happy ending, even though it's not for him, obviously, a good ending. But like, he's now notably, you know, the master poisoner that he wanted to be known as.
Oh, I have to enjoy it, but...
Right. Such is the nature of any true creative professional, you know? Yeah. You never get to see the...
Those monkey's paw type of wishes where, well, it came true, but you didn't specify that you'd be alive to enjoy it, so...
I am still curious, and maybe there's more that I'm missing, but... Was there ever a direct sort of pointing to him actually being a master poisoner? Or is it all bluster and all just kind of confidence man?
I mean, he does seem to be pretty good. Like what we see him do, like he's competent at what he's doing. He has a good handle on all the different substances and he has his immunities on lock. And I mean, he just definitely like over delivers at the bank.
So. Right.
I love how he tells Monza, look, like that, like, I, as far as I'm concerned, I did my job. As far as you're concerned, you didn't ask me to do this. So blame for this lies like a turd between us where neither of us is to blame for this. And she's like,
I love
the indignation.
How often Joe uses the word turd. Like, he really uses that word a lot.
That and fruits and piss and...
Oh, man.
Yeah. I guess my speculation on Morvir is it feels like he runs through a list of names, I think, two or so of like things that he had, or people that he had killed or poisoned. Or maybe it was Tokoska. I can't remember.
It was to Orso.
It's later in the book.
It was Orso. Okay. Orso is wondering what his bona fides are.
Right. And I feel like he was both, like, he did a lot of those, but it also felt like he was taking credit for some that he didn't do. And that was kind of one of those things that were, like, maybe unclear, because it also seemed like he was everywhere. Like, Morvir was over in the Union, and he was up in the North, and there were, like, some really weird names thrown in on that list.
Yeah,
like, it seems like maybe other poisoners didn't get caught.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that, like, has a lot of skills and knowledge, but nowhere near the skills and knowledge that he claims to. So he is like, he's pretty successful. What they ask him to do, he does know his stuff. It's not like it's all bluster. He's good at his job, But like when he's like, you know, what do we, you know, we never take chances. We're always super careful. And he's like saying this as he's adding extra caution acid first to the rope and Gum's crashing down because whoopsie doopsie. Like, and oh, are, would we say that was incautious of you, what you just did? Or are we saying we do make mistakes sometimes?
So it wasn't caution first after all. Yeah. Oh, man. And then like Day as an accompanying, you know, like foil to him in so many different ways, being just as competent and being the sort of the like why of Day is always like the big thing with me every time with Morvira. And it's just because he's a creepy asshole. And it's like the worst, you know, reason to keep her around because she could be accomplished and she absolutely could have gone out on her own. Now, competent and, you know, long lasting in the profession may be different for Day, but I don't know. I don't know.
I do love Morvira and Shiver, or Morvira and Day laughing at Shivers for saying that he saw magic. And they're like, oh, yeah, you saw magic. He's like, I saw a woman call up the mist. And they're like, yeah, was the mist purple?
Sure, buddy. Like,
oh, a woman said there should be mist and there was mist. You astound me. I'm convinced. There's definitely magic. It's like the stuff that, like, nowadays, if you saw a crack on the an insane person on the internet talking about stuff like that, you'd be like, oh, yeah, for sure, great evidence. And when he's like, you know, oh, the feared, you know, like, I saw that he was impervious to wounds, and, you know, and he really was. And I was saying, oh, so you're saying there was no wound, and then there was no wound? Wow! I'm totally convinced!
Yeah.
Yeah, science versus magic as a chapter was such a fun one to kind of interrogate. Because of that, and then in addition, later, Morvir absolutely shitting himself as Ishri explodes the barn with lightning and fire and everything else, and was just like, oh my god, I am so wrong. He's like, I want to die. I'm getting out of here.
Because it's like when Shivers is trying to explain to them, you obviously know that what Shivers is talking about is real, but you're like, yeah, I mean, it's not like Shivers... Yeah, what he's saying, like, that is what he saw. That's all he has to go on. And anyone hearing that secondhand would dismiss it. And you're like, no, I mean, like, he's right. Don't make fun of him. But also, I get why you are dismissing it, because it doesn't sound like great evidence.
I'm curious on, this is another point of somebody who approached this book first. Because there is no magic up to that point. I think that is before Shankt appears. Even the first couple chapters of Shankt existing as a character, there's no sort of magical abilities.
Well,
Shankt
is in chapter two, so I know
but
about
I think the first time he really shows anything is halfway through the book, maybe.
Yeah.
So I'm curious what somebody approaching this book first thinks about Shivers talking about magic, if they believe him or if they fall on the side of.
I think they would probably wonder, like, am I supposed to believe Shivers or not? Because, I mean, A Song of Ice and Fire is similar. I mean, if you didn't have, I don't know if you've read it, but if you didn't have, I mean, the show starts the same way. The prologue is the White Walkers. And if you didn't have that sort of bombshell prologue, there's no magic. It's just people and politics and killing and it's then, like, very, very, very much later we get some dragons and stuff, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like Lady Stoneheart and etc.
But in the first book,
the
prologue,
right,
of the White Walkers, and that tells you like there's something going on. But aside from that,
like, why would the rest of the world like really believe, you know, in that concept? Because it's such a rare and isolated case. I mean, even Logan was skeptical outside of the fact that he could talk to spirits in the first story, right? And so actually seeing art was something entirely different for him. And then, you know, you come into Jizal's perspective of whom, and Glockta's of whom, they're both totally abhorrently shocked, at the lack of need for stairs to assemble, as he just kind of takes the gradual ramp up into the House of the Maker. And then, in addition, when Baez blows people up into little meaty bits in front of Jizal for the first time out of the bathtub.
But it takes a while, even in, aside from Logan talking to spirits, Blade itself also has almost no magic until quite a ways in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that it's one of those things that it's meant to be, you know, sort of a larger, I mean, is it one of those things? It does give us the sense that, like, magic is still a really rare thing in the world, regardless.
Magic is leaving the world.
Yes. Yeah. By and large. Fleeing from it. Because the demons are sealed away, you know? They're on the other side.
All we have left is capitalism and oligarchy. I don't know why anyone reads these books nowadays. They're just not even relevant for our lives.
Not even reflective of the broligarchy that we live in today, you know? Sidebar, I'm betting that broligarchy is probably the Webster Merriam Word of the Year. And I'm putting that in
right now. If they're allowed to make it that by the end of the year.
God, yeah. If the dictionary survived to the end of the year, good call.
If the Ministry of Truth permits it.
Ministry of Truth via Doge. Oh, no. Ugh, the pain. The pain. Is that all the perspectives? Oh, obviously Shanked as well is kind of the final perspective.
The Shankle.
The Shanked of it all. How do we feel about Shanked in the end and sort of
the family man?
Family man.
Yeah, with Vitari?
Well, that's some lively dinner conversations.
Mm-hmm. Did you give me the human? No, please. Are his kids eaters? You know, there's a lot of questions.
That's an interesting question.
It's like how Zuckerberg doesn't let his kids use media. So Shanked is not going to let his kids.
You can't see the lizard people. You know, we can't let that happen. Just a bunch of chameleons.
So I feel like the last 20% of the book, every single time that we had another Shank perspective, it was another kind of bombshell of a revelation for me. Like there were a lot of great reveals. It was so much fun to read Shanked.
I love the part where he's negotiating his price and they're like, he's like, that's my price. No one's saying you have to pay it.
I mean,
also, I don't need it. I have to pay me now.
The thing I don't quite understand is if the whole point was to kill Orso in the end, why didn't he just do it right there when he was in front of Orso?
Well, it's not just to kill him, but to install different power in his place. Okay, so killing him wouldn't do the job. He would just go to his sons then.
Right. Good point. Yep.
Okay. See, that's what's the problem with traditional fantasy. You can't just kill the bad guy. There's a whole systemic problem.
Good.
Right.
Good point.
Power vacuums, man. You got to think about it. You got to think about your oligarchy. Come on.
It's almost like that's what the second series of Red Rising is about.
Right. Part of the reason that I really love that is because it interrogates that. But I think that that's also one of the fun underlying elements of all of this, too, is like the larger chess game that's happening now between like three forces, it seems, on sort of the magical level. But from Shank's perspective, too, I mean, beyond just playing the sort of oligarchical chess, I really like that he's the first magic perspective that we have. He's the first user of any sort of magic that exists.
Aside from Logan.
Well, okay. Logan, like, whispers to some fire sometimes, you know, and swallows a spirit once.
Not nothing.
That's true.
And Pharaoh.
Yeah, Pharaoh has got demon blood.
All right, I'm going back on this. The first perspective that uses art.
All right.
Which maybe not even, like, are eaters technically, like, using art, or is it something else? You know, is it more similar to, like, Pharaoh and the demon blood? It's an interesting, I don't know, it's an interesting perspective, the whole bullet time thing that he does.
But it's also interesting how Shanked, he isn't actually, like, it's a third element to this, but he's not really a competing force. He's just there to fuck shit up. He's just there to be like, I don't know what your game is, and I don't care, whatever it is, I'm messing it up. Like, if Baez was pro-Monza, then Shanked would be pro-Orso. If Baez is pro-Orso, then Shanked is pro-Monza. He's just like, I don't know what you're doing, whatever it is, I'm messing it up.
With anything to stop you.
Yes, but with the caveat of he is also opposed to anything Gurkle related as well. So he has to find the third
path.
Yeah,
but he's not like trying to like keep power for himself, or he has his own designs on what should happen. He's not there to put something else in place or to fight for his own plan. He's only there to ruin the plans of the people he doesn't trust and dislikes and wants revenge on.
Correct.
He's a spoiler.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a lot of ways, on the behalf of humanity, Shanked is our champion against
He's a psycho, but he's our
magic
psycho.
Underbellies. Yeah.
maybe not quite our vermin supreme, but
Jesus. Yeah, not quite. He's trying. He doesn't have the boot yet. But yeah, I appreciate kind of his spoiler nature in the story on the whole. So we'd kind of talked about this just briefly earlier as we kind of circled around adaptation. What do we think about casting some of these fools? Who fits where? You know, who's friendly? You know, that's... I initially, a couple of years ago, probably would have said Dave Bautista when I originally read it, but I'm not 100%. I mean, like, close, but I don't know. I think he's been too typecast in that kind of a role, so I'd almost want to see someone else.
Yeah. I mean, I think he could be good. I wouldn't object to him. Yeah. It's just friendly. He would definitely fit the bill. And he plays that type of character. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think he's too big.
You know what I actually think would be kind of, like, it would work? Be Jason Statham as friendly.
Ooh.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because he actually is a good comedic actor. Because he is supposed to be a shorter
dude. Yeah.
Yeah, but he's also, he's usually playing badasses and stuff, and friendly is pretty badass, but he's very funny. Like, when he's the comic relief, he's very funny.
I literally rewatched Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels last night because I could not fall asleep. And I was like, all right, you know, click back
but
in.
But like in that Melissa McCarthy movie where she's like the support for a spy and then she becomes the spy, Jason Statham is in
spy?
It. It might just be called Spy. Jason Statham's in that as like a really dumb like action guy. He's very funny at it.
Hell, even I think it's The Beekeeper as well is like a parody of the action movies that Jason Statham has been in and is kind of playing the same role, which is another great example of that. Yeah, he does have comedic acting chops. Doesn't get to use them nearly enough. Mm-hmm. That's a good idea. I like that.
I think that still like putting Jason Statham in here makes me really, really need this to again be a Guy Ritchie movie.
I mean, I would not object to Guy Ritchie directing First Law. That would be amazing.
Mm-hmm. It'd be so much fun. There are so many scenes in this. The Cardotti scene, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine it clearly. Exactly as Guy Ritchie would
like
direct this.
The part of this that is the most kind of tapping into Joe as a former film editor is the Monza in bed, Shivers in bed, and then whoops, they're not actually with each other. And I feel like that's totally scene that Guy Ritchie would know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Totally.
We talked a long time about that one and how you would like cleverly get away with it. Because PJ was like, I don't know how you do that. And I was like, you could totally do it.
Have you seen Rock and Rolla?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, love.
Like, they do the sex scene with Gerard Butler and Thandie Newton, where it's just like quick cuts of like them like making noises and showing a brief glimpse of flesh, and then they're just smoking. And it's like not this like long drawn out thing. It's just this like flash cuts of stuff. And like, I'm not saying you do it identically to that because he's already done that. But like something like that.
You could. Yeah.
Yeah, you could. You could do it that way. I was kind of upset that the audiobook betrayed that reveal. Because there's just the couple comments from the partners.
That's the trouble with a narrator that's that good. You're never gonna get tricked.
You're like, characters are so disparately.
Oh, but that's what I was gonna say too about Guy Ritchie. Just like Stephen Pacey is kind of like on the same wavelength as Joe Abercrombie, and that's why it's so good. He like gets it. He's on the same page. I think Guy Ritchie and Joe Abercrombie also would sort of like both be on the same page with how this should go and how it should look, and I think they would just work well together in that way. So that's also always really important.
I agree. Who plays Shivers?
I've always thought Ed Skrein should play.
I like that.
I'm going to be doing some
Googling.
He's
also friends with Tim Miller. So.
Wow. Because I don't know actors at all. this is
you
my biggest
Statham.
Weak spot.
Yeah.
I know a few, but this is my biggest weak spot, and Crossland knows that, and he asks this every fucking wrap-up all the time.
You have so much prep time. And this
Google
is the one
every
case
actor.
That's likely to happen. Yeah.
Just Google every actor in
them.
The world before every podcast. Yeah. Well, what's so hard about that?
Figure it out, buddy.
But what was the actor that you just mentioned?
Ed Skrein. Skrein is Skrein.
Okay, yeah. Yep.
He's your Shivers.
I can get behind that.
Because I think he can also pull off beginning Shivers and also post-eye removal scary Shivers.
Yeah, I think so too.
He can.
And he's attractive enough while still being scary and gruff enough.
Yeah, I'm trying to imagine him with one eye and giant burn marks. I think it'll work.
Yeah, do you remember Alita? Did you watch Alita with us, the rest of us that went at that time?
Nope.
PJ, to the movies? Okay, cool. Never mind.
And Deadpool.
Yeah, yeah. Also, in the Waste of Time Rebel Moon movies, of which I...
Do you think I've seen
waited
those?
Until the R-rated Guts came out at the very least, but...
Ed.
Poor Ed. But he did great. And I think that actually showed, again, that, like, you know, he can carry a bad script like he's done often for himself.
So, oh, yeah. One of my favorite movies he's like in that. Is not, like, a very well-known one. Probably didn't make him very much money. It was, like, an indie film that Natalie Dormer both, like, starred and directed and wrote in. And he plays, like, the co-lead with her. And it's, like, an action thriller. I think it's called In Darkness because she's blind. But she, like, auditorily witnesses a crime and gets, like, now pursued by people. And he's involved with it. Anyway, so I highly recommend that movie. And he, you know, it's actually a good movie that he gets to be in, which is nice for him.
Mm-hmm. For a change. Yeah, I think I like that. I think I wasn't coming around to it at first. Then I was like, all right, in the long run, I can totally see Skrine doing Shivers. Especially, I mean, again, we've read like the first part of The Heroes, but I think he could play Shivers in that incredibly as well. So
certainly from beginning to end, right, Professor Cold.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. But I could see him aging into it as well. So like that's the other side of it, too. Like he fits the eventual timeline of it all. So.
And he just generally has a Northman vibe.
Yeah, yeah. I was kind of like, in my head, I was going back to thinking about casting him in the original trilogy, and that's where my brain went at first. And I was like, do I have a better Shivers? I don't think so. So,
I mean, most actors that we would cast for Professor Cold are going to be too old for original trilogy Shivers. Because trilogy Shivers is like, get Timothy Chalamet or whatever.
Yeah, I was going back more to like, should Skrine be like Black Dao or like Dog Man or something? Not literally, but like I was thinking, like, could he fit there instead? Because I almost picture him like a different Northman. But then the more that I thought about as Shivers gets older, I think that he fits. He also about matches the Rebecca Ferguson sort of on screen appearance. So I think that would work as well.
Yeah, he could be good with her.
I'm in. I kind of want Shanked to be like an unassuming dude. So that's like the...
But, like, the way Monza describes him in the beginning is that he's got, like, a corpse's rictus smile. Like,
yeah.
I feel like it's giving Willem Dafoe.
Ooh. That would be so cool.
That's, man.
That's a really good call with that smile description.
Sorry to Willem Dafoe.
No, that was a compliment.
Was not kind to you.
that is complimentary corpse's smile, Willem Dafoe.
I love when people associate me with corpses.
Hey, I've seen The Lighthouse. I know what's up. I was thinking...
Hey, you know, actually, Robert Pattinson wouldn't be bad as Shivers.
So that's what I was going to say. I was totally on that page. That was where my brain went. Because I kind of wanted to be like a gangly, like kind of skinny dude that's like, again, very unassuming. But also, like, Robert Pattinson does some like really messed up stuff and like facial, you know, things
before
as well.
Seeing could, the like, Batman, I don't know terrifying. If I would have said that. But after seeing the Batman, he could be Shivers.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, it was Good Times, I think, was the first time that I got hit in the face with it. And I was like, oh, Robert Pattinson does deeply understand the assignments that he's given. So
I think he's a fantastic actor. It's just more like there's a lot of good actors. They just wouldn't be the right vibe for the character. And so, like, I do generally think Robert Pattinson, I more so associate with him with characters. Like, I mean, the Batman is like a rich trust fund kid, and he tends more like posh, rich, and maybe deeply fucked up, but like, you know, he might be more of a Giselle.
Yeah.
But, like, I think he could get, like, roughed up enough and get the accent right to be a Northman as well. He could do it.
Yeah. Oh, I was saying for Shanked instead. I don't mind him as Shanked. That's what I... Because, like, it's a union guy of whom looks young, but is kind of, like, gangly and has been around for a long time. So that's kind of why I kind of like the unassuming. It also would then be kind of a fun nod to the fact that he's kind of playing a vampire again in a way. But that maybe might be too much for him.
I mean, he got to play a bat, right? After
yeah. vampire to bat back to cannibal vampire bat man. The other ones, of course, I mean, classically, Morvir is kind of the one that I want to be, I think, the most surprised by like some little sniveling guy. Now we've said the Batman, my brain just went to Paul Dano, like, immediately.
He could do it.
He could do
Wouldn't
it.
Wouldn't object to that.
Yeah.
Oh, no, isn't you know who perfect. I want to play? This okay, he has to play either Casca or Morvir, and I think he could do either one brilliantly. Walton Goggins.
Oh my God, Casca. You put him in Casca for sure, in my opinion.
But we totally got right. Brana for Casca.
Yeah. Yeah, true, true, true. If we just have Hercule Poirot with his nice mustache.
I just think about how much Morvir talks and how good Walton Goggins is at the yapping, which Casca talks a ton as well, which is why I think he'd be good at either one. But that, like, yeah, the creepifying.
Yeah. PJ, you know Goggins from Gemstones and other things.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Just making sure. Just had to double check your.
Sorry, I was doing some radar. Googling because the guy that I think could play Morvir, Darren Brooks.
Who is Darren Brooks?
He was Alex in Blue Mountain State. I don't think he's been in pretty much anything else big since then.
I've not seen that, so.
I have not but seen Blue Mountain State.
I am now talking myself into Walton Goggins as Morvir, and if that's the case, I want Sam Rockwell to play Casca.
That's so interesting. I love that we're circling this. Now that you brought up Sam Rockwell, I like him more as Morvir, and I like I'm like hitting the polar opposite
because
every time
I think
you bring
Sam
up someone
Rockwell,
new. I'm like, man.
Sam Rockwell can do the fatherly caring part with like little Monza and Benna. And he has a much more kind of like lovable like thing beneath it all. I mean, Walton can have that too, but Walton has got all those teeth. And the way he talks as Morvir would be perfect.
Good call. Yeah. I just think about like Rockwell in all the Martin McDonagh movies and just the way that he does, like, I don't know, either like village idiot so well. And so like part of that is Morvir has sort of a village idiotness to him.
So does Cop.
Very true. But like, I don't know, I'm philosophizing. There's a little bit more, in my opinion, of like Goggins in that, but I like either of them as any of them. So Dreamcast.
Also, which can pull off a mustache better.
Yeah, it is. Goggins, right? He pulls off a mustache.
Oh,
I should not be the judge of the mustache.
Damn.
You know, I'm looking at a full bearded picture of Sam Rockwell, and I think you're right. You could shave that down, and that's a nice clean Casca there. He could do.
I'm just thinking of all those scenes where he's like, "Oh, you stabbed me right in the heart," like Sam Rockwell, or like, "I'm here for breakfast," Sam Rockwell.
That's good. I dig it. I dig it. Cool. Well, we've done it, so Tim Miller doesn't have to do it.
You're welcome, Tim.
We appreciate you
clear your schedules.
Yeah. Figure it out. Make it work. You can do this. Come on. You don't need to be in Fallout, Walton Goggins. Don't worry about it. Or Righteous Gemstones. We're good. We don't need you there anymore. Priority number one.
First laws, chance of a lifetime. Come on, guys.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Who would play Vitari?
Oh, that's a good call. All right. I apologize to everybody who got upset about me constantly talking about how Vitari had curly hair. I don't know where that came from, but I talked about it a lot.
Number of emails and messages. Anyway.
I think it came from the fact that her kids have curly hair. Severard talks about that. But
who for Vitari? We appreciate the apology, PJ. On behalf of the listeners, I accept your apology.
I don't even know what to look up right now. Spiky headed.
Gillian, what's her name? Last name. Oh my God. Totally failing me. Irish actress. Oh God. Must Google. Other thoughts while I panic and freak out trying to remember her name? No? Cool.
I
Karen Gillian. Gillen.
What?
Oh, you are muted or cannot hear you at the moment.
She has to play opposite Shank. Sorry, I muted myself because there was silence.
Yeah, that's one of the things is trying to kind of pair those two, but not necessarily. Because that reveals, like, way late.
You know what? Now that she's older, I actually think Natalie play Vitari.
Yeah, I like Natalie Dormer in pretty much every... I mean, like, since The Tudors, right? Like, she's been great in most things.
Like we said about Robert Pattinson, she's a good actress. She's got the chops for most things. It's just, is she going to be the right vibe?
Right. I think she could totally do it. I do really like Karen Gillan as well. Amy Pond from Doctor Who and like Nebula from Guardians of the Galaxy and whatnot. I think she works in my head pretty well. There was a movie, it's called Bullets or something like that, where there was just like, or Duel or something like that, where it was just like all gunfire.
I think it was on Netflix, right?
Yeah.
I think I saw that. I just can't picture her as like a mother and a wife to Shanked. Whereas I can picture that for Natalie Dormer.
For sure. That works.
Isn't that one of the, I mean, that's kind of part of the point for Vitari though, is to like, it was not her.
She's
it was
like
surprising
an
that
mother.
She was a mother. It was
I also think Natalie Dormer would be a better Monza than Rebecca Ferguson, because I do think she has like hard ass, badass, like, I mean, like the way she is in The Hunger Games, you know?
Yeah.
Like she's about red hair or whatever. And she's a little older now. So the fact that she's like, you need an actress that could conceivably be a Monza type, but then also equally like, once you see them as a mom and wife to Shanked, you're like, well, okay, I guess I accept that as well.
Good point.
So you would recast Ferguson as Dormer, or excuse me, Monza as Dormer.
She wouldn't be my first choice for Monza, but sure. I already think she would be better for Monza, and I definitely think she could play. But again, with Monza, like it's not like a thing that's mentioned once. It's repeated over and over again, like the dark hair and dark eyes, and she's like so Mediterranean
looking.
It's
Venice refrain, right? Yeah.
I mean, other people comment on it too. Like when Shanked is healing her, he's like, your dark hair, your beautiful dark hair, it'll grow back. Yeah. And like, and I think, I mean, I guess my impression of this part of the world at first law is sort of more Mediterranean anyway. Mm-hmm. So Rebecca Ferguson just looks so Scandinavian. Like,
Yeah. I also think the more that we've talked about this too, I think that Rebecca Ferguson would be a solid cast for Vitari. Like she does have the more like sharp angular features. And does still have that same sort of like intensity
about
her.
Yeah. All right, let's do the other way. Natalie Dormer, you be Monza, and Rebecca, you play Vitar. You've been demoted. Sorry.
Rebecca, you're still attached. You're still a primary player. We're so sorry to let you know as the casting directors of Tim Miller, Guy Ritchie's Best Served Cold.
But like Natalie, too, is very fair. So like ideally, I would want to cast somebody who is like dark.
Yeah, yeah. More in the... Again, like Mediterranean, Italian is sort of a lot of what we talked about and fixated on as we're kind of reading through things. Is Styria feels very adjacent to Italy. It feels adjacent to like Garibaldi in the expedition.
Well, I think it was largely, I think Best Served Cold was inspired by Italian city-states feuding. So like it's everyone's described as looking kind of Italian.
right. Yeah, you know, from a research perspective, you know, one of the things that I personally want to ask Joe at some point is like, you know, talking about research, Garibaldi feels like so central to like where Cosca comes from as a character, trying to unify the states and everything like that in Italy and kind of being this flamboyant guy, if that's like a draw as to where he researched. But nonetheless,
but also Cosca was just like that from the first law. And he just was like, oh, I have this guy left over.
Right.
Let me use him.
Yeah, Joe very much has his toys in his toy box, and he just pulls them out when and if they fit. Otherwise, create someone new. Make a friend.
The stuff he bought at the grocery store that he didn't use in the recipes that he planned, and was like, well, what do I got left in the fridge? Guess I'll use
salted
you.
Salted tomatoes and apples tonight. Yeah. Yeah. Vitari's good. I totally forgot that. One character that we've completely neglected to think about at all, including all of the villains, is Orso. And even talking about Orso in general as this sort of character that holds over between the series. I love the end reveal of Orso being like, I couldn't believe that you would betray me in sort of his whole stint that he goes on.
Them both
on.
Being like, we've all gone too far to correct this now, but at least
in
the end, we do know. Whoopsie. <Yeah.
laughs> In the end, we both know that we fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
If only you guys had communicated.
Just talk about it.
Yeah.
Come Everyone on. In First Law still needs therapy.
Very true. Very true. Always or so John Cena for sure. Right? Great. Cool. We're done.
John Cena.
The reaction was worth every. And then I almost talked into my glass. It was great.
Oh boy. I could see Stellan Skarsgård.
That does put it back into the like Nordic vibe as opposed to the Italian, but
if that's who we're casting.
I guess we're casting opposite.
Doing Rebecca. It's taking place in Norway now, the feuding city states of Norway.
Yeah, Skarsgård I could kind of see as like Bethod. But
ooh.
I could see that.
I don't know.
I could see a younger Skarsgård fitting into like the shoes of Bethod or something like that. Honestly, I originally had Bill as
Alexander,
like shanked.
I'm gonna say Alexander Skarsgård is like nearing 50. Like he could play Bethod.
Totally. Yeah. He'd be great.
Fair.
That's a good call. I like that as Bethod.
He could actually play Logan.
Yeah, he'd be a great Logan. I mean, hell, the portrayal in the Northmen alone, like, totally earns it.
You're gonna have to ugly him up a bit.
Yeah, you could do that. Wouldn't take much.
Oh, you know who'd be good as Shanked? Michael Fassbender.
Ooh, See, I've got a soft spot for Michael Fassbender.
And when he wants to, he can have a rictus.
Yeah, he's got that grin.
He's got that wiry build, too, that, like, I know, like, and he's played malnourished characters before.
He feels very unionish. Christian Bale, you know, could be Shanked. Anyone could be Shanked. Shanked is like we can fit anyone into this role, and we just need someone really weird to do it. Again, I will once again posit one of the younger
Skarsgårds.
I was about to say,
I was trying to think of a joke one, and then I was like, actually, Adam Knight actually not be bad. I was going to say Tom Cruise, but I was like, hey, he's got a creepy smile. Tom Cruise could totally play
that. That would be one hell of a cast. I would. Oh my God. That is.
I mean, Tom Cruise playing Shang would be a lot like Tom Cruise in Tropic Thunder. The casting that no one saw coming.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember. I know that PJ hasn't because I tried to talk to him about it, but did you see Abigail? Movie from the Ready or Not guys, the vampire ballerina movie.
Did not.
Regardless, Matthew Good could also.
Oh, I love him. Pretty good. He would be fantastic. Yeah. He would be good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the other one. Great as Ozymandias in the maligned Watchmen movie, but plays well.
He's really good in Brideshead Revisited.
Oh. Yes. Right. you had mentioned that, and I have it on my short list of things that I eventually need to watch, and I was like, I haven't watched it yet, and I was like, oh, absolutely. That.
Oh, you know who would be a good Morvir, even though I already like who I cast, but in case you need a runner-up.
We gotta get a list going, you know.
Andrew Scott.
Oh, Andrew Scott would be great. PJ, we were talking about you watching Fleabag, like, last week.
Yeah, I still have to. Yeah. I haven't. I haven't started that yet.
But have you seen Sherlock?
I have seen Sherlock.
He's Moriarty.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I could see that.
Yeah. He could totally do it. He could also play Mean Shanked.
We can't say everybody. Okay. Rebecca Ferguson can play Shanked.
Yes. Rebecca Ferguson could play Shanked.
So
convincingly.
We'll make Vitaria man.
Danny DeVito. You know?
Oh, no.
Just kidding.
Christopher Walken.
There we go.
Is Stephen Pacey too old to play Orso?
No, that would be great. And that'd be a fun little nod. Oh, I love that.
That would be great.
That's brilliant. Yes.
There you go. I think we found our way.
Make it so.
Yeah.
I bet he has a line on Abercrombie. I bet he could get a hold of him.
You think they talk?
Yeah. His surprise cameo in House of the Dragon was a highlight of the second season for me, for sure. I was like so amped. I was like, wait a minute, I know that voice.
It's hard to actually identify his own voice. We're so used to him doing voices.
Right. And then he was a character in the recent Secret Level, like Love, Death, Robots, Tim Miller thing, no joke, and was played opposite Arnold Schwarzenegger. And so Arnold's doing his Arnold thing, and then Pacey came out and
Arnold
was like, wait a minute. Arnold should play Guslov, that dying king. That'd be great. I wanted to ask one more question about adaptation on kind of the outset. So one of the things, obviously, with adaptation come sacrifices. How long could we imagine this movie being? Do we imagine that things get trimmed? One of the things that PJ and I said is it feels unlikely that we'd go through 7 without either montaging them in some way or, you know, something like that. Where would we focus in more? Where would we draw back the focus? What would we do?
Well, since this is a revenge story that was at least in part inspired by the tradition, the long tradition of classic revenge stories, and I did just see the three-hour-long Monte Cristo that was just made by the French cinema.
Just do that, yeah.
And I was like, well, they fit. They had to cut a lot, and they did change some stuff, but if that was sufficient, I think, to tell a pretty good version, if a condensed version of Monte Cristo. And I don't think Best Served Cold is more complicated than Monte Cristo. So as long as we let the movie be three and a half hours, and obviously we'll still have to cut some stuff, but yeah, we can do it.
Fair. So the editor's pen is just go longer. Just, you know, put more money into it. Let it be.
And I think a lot I mean, it can be trimmed also just in terms of a lot of the stuff that has to be explained and told to you and described to you. The visual just immediately shows it to you, so you don't have to spend words describing it. And there are a lot of sort of more cinematic moments in Best Served Cold that only are capable of being cinematic because Joe is describing to you, like a screenplay, what this scene looks like. And a scene doesn't have to describe it to you. It takes 1 second and you can see it. So some of the time would be saved in that.
Like the duel with Ganmark. I mean, such a great example of like, you can immediately like see and hear like the nicks at the base of the statue and like begin to feel it, you know, taking damage and then crumbling eventually into the point at which it stabs. And that takes
the whole opening with Monza getting almost killed and thrown off the mountain. Like there's so many words that have to be used to describe logistics, and so much of this is action. And so a lot of action is a lot faster to watch than it is to describe. There's that.
It's true. We
highly recommend, though, the French Count of Monte Cristo. If you can watch it, it's so good.
I'll have to find and check that out.
PJ, your laundry list is long.
Once I get through my several years worth of watching to...
My brother and I, on Martin Luther King Day, we drove... So I live in Los Angeles. We drove all the way to Aliso Viejo to watch it in the cinema. And then drove back.
That's fun.
Because it was the only cinema That's showing awesome. It.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
Paying tolls both ways was not fun, which I didn't know I'd have to do.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I don't think there are any toll roads in Minnesota.
Just consider it a part of the ticket price. You know, it's fine. It's fine.
It's like this part of the adventure sucks, but. Oh, well.
Fair. That's a good commitment, though, to like do that whole thing.
Made a day of it.
I'm failing to remember the name of the character, which is part of the reason that I returned to this being the only cuttable thing in my mind. The old mercenary of whom takes over.
Oh, What's Faithful? No, is it Faithful?
Yes, Faithful Carpi. It's such a quick exchange compared to a lot of the rest of them that like, but also the like emotional beat of him like not really wanting to betray her. It kind of feels like that's also like the first moment that she kind of turns around and looks at the camera and is like, oh, revenge isn't good after all, and doesn't feel good about that whole thing. So I don't know. That's like the one that I feel like could be refined in some way or like merged in with something else or, you know, maybe reduced.
Yeah, it's very possible that instead of whatever happens, 7 men must die, that the movie's going to be whatever happens, 3 men must die.
Right. Yeah.
We just kind of like merge them into like the same character.
Yeah. Or the two princes, you know, die at the same time in some way, you know, at some time, and then you move other things around. But 7's just
Orso could have one son. He doesn't need two.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got a daughter, too. You know, like, that's enough kids for most people.
Yeah. I think it's possible to, like, montage some of them into it. Like, Gaba. I feel like it's important
Well, Gaba you kind of need, because that's, like, the brutality, you know, right off the bat.
But a lot of them are kind of almost that, like, it.
Yeah.
The first one at the bank is kind of a Guy Ritchie-esque punchline. So we do quick cuts of entering the bank, attempting multiple times to poison him, and that just keeps not working. But we don't have all these long conversations. We have the Guy Ritchie-esque quick cuts of, like, attempt, 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 failure. And then the next day, screams of everybody dying and Monza being like, what the fuck? Like, that's like 2 minutes of screen time.
Yeah.
Right.
That's true.
Yeah. Or the Soderbergh, like, squares moving along, and then you kind of, like, get the idea, and then everything goes wrong from square to square as opposed to going right as a montage is.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be great.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I think I'd still stick with that we talked about, Crossland, as we were going through it, was the secondary revenge plot of Koska's
revenge. Yeah.
Which is important and nice to have as a like side-by-side with Monza's, but I think it could be either greatly reduced or cut entirely. Just for the sake of saving some time. But I like having it there.
I think it's
a great sort of addition to the story, but it makes every single scene need to be that much shorter and that much more condensed. It would make living in a scene a lot more difficult.
On the other side of that, maybe people are ready for 3-hour movies again, you know, a la, you know, Dune
or
Part 2.
4 hours with an intermission. I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard that The Brutalist has an intermission.
Yeah. Does it?
So, yeah.
That's awesome.
So, bring back intermissions.
True. Love that idea.
Here for it.
Why not? Everyone wants to go pee and check their phone anyway.
So dehydrated watching Count of Monte Cristo because I didn't want to miss a second of it. So I just like didn't drink anything. By the end of the movie, I was like, I'm so thirsty. Normally by the end of the movie, I'm like, I need to pee. Yeah. But no, by the end of that movie, I was like, I need a drink, a drink, a drink, a drink, a drink.
So, ill-founded revenge quest, you know, as it is, ends on sort of this dour note of Shivers kind of heading off into the distance. Obviously, we've already started to pick up with him in The Heroes, but one of the things I'd love to throw is, you know, what else do we hope to see, you know, PJ mostly, but what else do we wish to see out of the future of our characters here?
Just mean what we would have hoped had we not seen what happens
right.
next.
Right, also that, yeah.
Because I was like, I already know what happens next.
Yeah, yeah, right.
I want a full novel with one perspective, and that perspective is Friendly.
Oh, Friendly. I feel like if we did that, it would be like Joe Abercrombie's Slow Regard of Silent Things. But it would be about Friendly.
I'm here for it.
A nice little novella.
No.
Novella from the perspective of someone who's a little different.
Don't diminish him. Give me a full fantasy-length novel, Crossland.
You can count every page. There will be plenty of them for you to count.
So many blank pages that are just there for Friendly to count them. That would be a metatextual.
One, two.
A metatextual. Write the book not about Friendly, but a book that Friendly would want to read.
A book for Friendly.
Mm-hmm. Oh man, so good. So
imagine good. Friendly discovering Sesame Street. One, oh two, God. Three.
The count would be his best friend, or he would try to kill the count. Unclear.
His hero.
I think. Yeah. I want to say every year.
Would he have a boner at the count anyway?
There is a published version, like a published book of every known prime number. I'm pretty sure that you can get like.
Friendly's
bound.
Already got a boner.
Yeah, you just mentioned that.
Friendly would like that.
Number mentioned.
Take Friendly to a statistics class. Whew. He's never leaving.
Dude would have no idea. Yeah. Sampling as a concept? Oh my God.
Friendly's OnlyFans is just a statistics class.
It's that and it's soup.
Friendly goes to universities and audits statistics classes as when he's feeling
rowdy. That's the future
we
really want for him.
He goes and always volunteers to be a poll worker so he can count the votes.
I would feel pretty
he's,
secure
he's really
in my
the one you want in charge.
If Friendly was in charge of all the polling.
I would not need a recount. I would fully trust that system.
Yeah. And if I asked for one, I think I would get a cleaver to the head, so I'm not going to do that.
No, I think if you asked for one, he'd be delighted.
Oh, fair.
You want me to count it again?
Be more like a,
sure.
I feel like it'd be more like a you don't trust me thing that I counted it well the first time, but...
As long as you didn't say it because you didn't trust him, if you were just like, can you count it again? He'd be like, oh, sure. It would be my pleasure. Yeah.
Literally. So the Book of Friendly. All right, PJ.
The Book of Friendly.
No other
wishes.
That's all you want. Just it. Oh, my God.
You're also a man of simple desires, just like Friendly.
I neglect to think or remember that. Yeah. Well done. Well done, my friend. Cool. PJ, any other questions? Any other thoughts? Leanna, any thoughts, questions about the best first law book? I feel like I've just kidding.
Well, I said why it's no longer my favorite. Yeah. Why is it still your favorite?
For me, I think the part that still resonates is a lot of the efficiency of storytelling in it, in the way that it delivers on character in so many different facets. And to me, it's also the quotes and the interrogation of philosophy and also the meaninglessness of philosophy simultaneously. Like the whole idea that Kostka teaches Monza, you know, Vercurio and Bieveld and all of these other philosophers, and then she kind of just picks and chooses what to use as opposed to that's adhering to a single philosophy, you know?
That's what one everyone of the reasons. Does.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's emblematic of like, you know, sure, I've read a lot of like Stoics and I've read like Ethics and I've read all of these different kind of components, but like you pick and choose to validate your own opinion and your own worldview. And I think that that is one of the things that this maybe didn't set out for to be like a core theme, but I think it is one of the best examples of that in the world. And I think we could all use a little bit of reflection in that realm, or modern society could use a little bit more of like, hey, you're just cherry picking to get the results that you want. Or to feel validated in your end goals or means. So that, the characters, I mean, the overall length of the story, the pacing is incredible. I just, it's one of those that like hit me and then stuck with me immediately in and amidst the rest. So it's no Thief of Always, but it's close.
That's fair. Oh yeah, it's solid. It's still 5 stars. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just when I first read it, my review that's I think still on Goodreads was just like, can I give it 6? And now I'm like, it's 5. It's
5.
Absolutely,
for sure.
100% 5.
Yeah, fair. PJ, where does this sit among your repertoire of the first law books that you've read so far? Or the books that we've read in general? Yeah.
It's high. I really enjoyed it. I think.
Fucker. He doesn't
I think
get
I still
it.
Like Last Argument better.
It's okay to be wrong.
But I don't know.
There's not enough Glockta.
It's true.
There's not enough Glockta. There's some Glockta, but only roundabout.
Adjacent Glockta.
There's roundabout Glockta. And we need direct Glockta.
I think for me, I think it's a fantastic revenge story. It absolutely is. And mm-hmm. does a great job, as all good revenge stories do, of pointing out both the hypocrisy and the futility of revenge. But I think one of the reasons why Count of Monte Cristo on reread, I kind of like it better the more I read it. And Best Served Cold, I still love it. It doesn't like wow me every time that I read it the way that it did the first time, is because the revenge, like there's a marvelous amount of variety considering how lacking in variety the revenge, like the seven revenges,
plot.
Like how what yeah. we do. Like it is all just variations on like violence and killing. And with Count of Monte Cristo, there it's not, in fact, he's kind of not about killing people. He's about making them
a lot
suffer.
Of shame.
He's like, death is too good for you. So there's just like so much more complexity and creativity and variety in the approach to how you construct revenge. Monza's is like, how do we kill him? Kill him. Kill him. Kill him all.
More
kill, him
kill
all.
Bill.
And so,
than, yeah.
Yeah, it's much more Kill Bill. And so I feel like and Kill Bill kind of has this problem, but again, it's sort of like, how many different ways can we do like a different thing where each one is like, it's not going to feel samey where we're just going around killing people. So I think given that's the case, there's a lot of variety, but it's like variety within a limited like range. And so the limited range of it is that none of these revenges are a more complicated kind of psychological revenge than on reread. Like I'm less gripped by it because there's like kind of less for me to chew on. There's poignant moments, certainly. And like with Faithful, it's like, do I really want revenge? How is this echoing what I already did? What is it? I mean, it's all there. Great themes, great character stuff, and all the stuff in between. But I think that's what keeps like has made it has diminished it in my estimation, is that ultimately is just kill, 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 kill.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. The while that does exist in sort of the story and is definitely the primary driving motivator of this sort of form of revenge, I think the other side of it too, for me, from a reason that I love it, is because like we have in some ways, like I think putting pure hero in an Abercrombie sentence is an oxymoron, but Schenkt has a heroic note that almost no other character in the story does in the way
antithesis.
Yeah, right. Well, exactly, right? Like, to call him a pure hero is to totally, you know, fail at the idea.
Basically Aragorn.
Yeah, yeah, right. Exactly.
Viggo Mortensen would be a good Schenkt.
It'd actually be a great Schenkt. Also, he's had plenty of experience with cannibals in the road. But yeah, that's part of the reason that I love it, especially is I feel like it's still a commentary on heroism, but there's sort of the larger picture of like you can fight against the system. Yeah.
We need a red haired Vitari. So Cate Blanchett from Borderlands.
Oh, yeah. Oh God. Wait, hang on. Also, it is also deeply funny to me. Did you see Borderlands?
No.
Okay. So I went and saw it in theaters because it was like $4 or something like that. An hour and a half.
Those are $4. You're never going to get back.
It's true. And an hour and a half of my life that is forever gone. Yeah. The tragedy of that movie is that it was clearly directed by Eli Roth and Tim Miller to be R-rated. And they edited out all of the gore and replaced it with like sparks. And there's clearly blood flying everywhere and it's just not there. And like
one of the most hilarious things of all time is watching Kevin Hart attempt to explain his character. And it sounds like someone, like a kid who didn't read the book that they were supposed to read for class, just kind of like vamping and being like, well, it's a character and they have a past and they are doing things. And what's really interesting about them is the way that the past makes them do things. In the
Kevin
present,
Hart felt edited like, into the rest of the movie, like, to be clear.
Were
like,
you
that's,
in this
that's
movie?
Definitely a problem. Yeah.
Like, do you have a character? Like, what are you talking about?
What's really funny about that is it is also one of Kevin Hart's best acting roles ever. He plays it shockingly well and doesn't play like his same jokiness, which is crazy to say.
Would you cast Kevin Hart to play an unfunny character?
Exactly. And he plays like dry witticism, which is, I mean, I guess it shows that he has a little bit of range, but yeah. He kind of felt, like I said, like edited into the rest of the movie in some places, which was super weird. But Tim Miller, director of Best Served Cold, did most of the reshoots because Eli Roth wanted nothing to do with it. And also like Craig Mazin, writer of obviously like The Last of Us in Chernobyl, stripped his name from the script when the studio put down that it had to be PG-13. And so he removed all claims that he had on working on that movie. One of the few times that they've allowed a pseudonym to take over, which is crazy. So,
but you were talking about the themes and the greatness of Vesper Cold when I
and then you said Cate Blanchett and my brain spiraled
short-circuited
out of control. Yeah.
Kate Blanchett has that effect.
She could do Vitari, though.
That does remind me of my favorite joke in The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, when they're like, oh, Kate Blanchett, she's such a great actress. She's such a great actress. And they're like, is she? Or is she just tall?
Yeah, it's fair. Tara is definitely completely around the fact that she's tall, and that's why it works.
There we go.
Was it foreshadowed?
It was in the cards. Kevin Hart as friendly?
Not as Schenkt.
Okay, Kevin Hart is Ishri, okay? We'll just...
Shivers?
Shivers? Could do a great Shivers. Best of Cold also has a number of my personal favorite quotes from the series. I wouldn't
I wouldn't seriously want Kevin Hart to play Shivers, but I would want a cutscene of Shivers delivering the line of like why his name is Shivers. It's like, oh, because like my day, because people are afraid of me and they're shivering in terror. I want Kevin Hart delivering that line, like, you know, in like defending himself. He's like, well, I'm called Shivers because like, people shiver and it's like
that is the perfect like level of humor that you want for that initial presentation. But yeah, a lot of my favorite quotes also come out of this. I did in the last 2 weeks, I reread or 3 weeks at this point. It's been a little bit of a stretch, but the Heroes, Red Country, and Sharp Ends, and kind of our preparation for things that we have going forward. And I don't think that my opinion has changed on where I rank this book and within the series, but I do think that I'm with you on some later quotes becoming more impactful and more like there just are so many juicy ones in Red Country in particular.
I was going to say Red Country remains my least favorite, and it also remains the best quotes of all of First Law are in Red Country.
Yeah. I do, again, want to just reiterate that part of the reason, like, I love fixating on philosophy and getting to step into this Mediterranean Italian world and getting, like, the nice historical fantasy bend to the rest of this.
You mean just, Sweden?
Yes. Because it is cold, right? That's what the title means, right?
Yeah. Maybe that's why they cast Esther or Rebecca Ferguson, because they saw the title and they're like, the uppermost north.
Yeah. And Stellan Skarsgård is shanked. You know, you could totally do it. Hi, Cosmo. Cool. Yeah. So that's ultimately where I'd rank it or where and why it sits there for me. It was just a book that blew my hair back and still does on rereads. Maybe in a couple years I'll soften. But right now, that's still where I stand.
It certainly opens with a bang.
It really does. Yeah. Yeah. And banging set of siblings. That was the worst. I hated that whole thing as it spilled out of my mouth.
My friend just started reading Vesperfold, and she's 100 pages in, and she was like, yeah, like, I was so sad when Benna died, but what should I expect reading First Law? She's like, so I'm 100 pages in, and, you know, Monza is definitely hard set on her revenge, and she thinks it's going to make her happy, and I don't think it is, but I was like, yep, that's about it.
PJ keyed into it a little bit right off the bat.
A little with Benna and Monza. Yeah.
Their dialogue, the dialogue between them as they're riding.
They sound like a couple.
Yeah. I thought they were married until it was revealed they were siblings.
So you got double shocked. First, it's the jump scare that they're siblings, and then it's the jump scare that, no, you were right, they are fucking.
I was right. Right away.
It was just the delayed gratification of it all. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and that initial scene is one, man, I love what he does in that initial scene, setting everything up, and like all of the different people that we're going to chase down and kill for all of these various reasons, deserving or undeserving. And that's just another thing, you know? What is it? Blood red sunset passing over the horizons.
Oh. So
sunrise was the color of bad blood. There it is.
Yep, that's it.
Bad blood. That's
bad blood and stolen gold.
Sounds just like Legolas.
Just like Orlando Bloom is shanked. Yeah. Got it. Perfect. Hey, love actually. It. Okay.
Shanked really is an every man.
Yeah. He's an any man, actually.
There's a little shanked in us all.
I think if we could resurrect dead actors, Chris Farley would play a good shanked.
Play a great shanked. An absolutely great shanked. One of the quotes that I pulled out as I was kind of reading through this and wanted to kind of use to punctuate the thing is, I love the Costco quote, "Whatever is the purpose of dead heroes if not to pass on stolen flags to more prudent fellows in the rank behind?" And I think that that's a perfect segue into the heroes. So here we are now with him. Oh, Costco.
Yap.
He's a yapper of all time. He's the yapper.
This edition of Best Served Cold, the quote they decided to feature on the back is, "That was the difference between a hero and a villain, a soldier and a murderer, a victory and a crime. Which side of a river you called home?"
Oh, man. Which edition of is the Best Served Cold is that?
It's the...
I don't know. I feel like I've never seen it before, which is why I'm...
Oh, computer-aided crafting.
Looks really nice.
It's very pretty. It is my favorite book in the series, and it's the only one that I don't have a special edition for of some kind or a signed edition, which is just like...
Fake fan.
What am I doing? Big fan. Yeah.
Fake fan.
Pained.
Like Casca. Right in the heart.
Yeah, really. Like, you just had to stab me right at the end here. You had to do that to me? Dirty.
Well, dirty. I mean, wouldn't have to do it if you had a special edition or something. Like,
Jesus Christ.
And you did make the choice to confess.
Well done. All of the puns, all of the first law puns forever.
You should have seen my email to Joe. It was nothing but first law puns. And I showed it to, a few people. But one person I showed it to was like, I can't believe he replied to you. I would never reply to this email. And I was like, fuck you. He did reply, so it worked.
I think we made mention of this. Maybe it's in the Heroes episode. I totally forget. But we got two emails recently from people. One was this like really long, intricate, thought out reason as to why Lysander deserves redemption, which was incredibly well written. And I completely disagree with you, Ryan. However,
I'm really happy for you, but you're wrong.
The second email that we got the same day, like an hour later, was some guy correcting a pronunciation of sovereign, but in an email. So he just puts the word sovereign in quotes, and that super helped. Thank you.
Not even like a phonetic, like,
no,
spelling out. Okay.
Hey, guys, this is how you say sovereign. Say it like that.
It's like when I see when people type out potato, potato, and I'm like, you just wrote potato twice. Like, it doesn't work in text.
And if you want it to work in text, you have to intentionally misspell it. So which one is it?
I loved it. I think it's funny.
Yeah. No, they were both very funny, but it killed me. The juxtaposition of those two things, like a beautiful, you know, 12 paragraph essay and then two lines about how we can't pronounce things correctly. It's great.
Be better.
We're trying, you know, I'm trying not to tuck in my cup. I've done better in the back half of this episode than I did in the front half.
No, you didn't.
It's like, 'cause your cup is empty.
Did you want me to talk? Yeah, it is. That is why.
That's why. So don't take credit
for
that.
You can't just tell me out like that.
Oh, God.
Dang. All right.
You have to be realistic.
Well, yeah, you do have to be realistic about these things. So very happy to have you back on the show. We will definitely have you back in the future if you want to talk about First Law. I don't think that's in your...
So it's a promise or a threat?
Yeah. But it was great to have this conversation with you and hear your incorrect opinions about my favorite book. Yeah.
Oh. Just pronounce sovereign correctly, okay?
Okay. We'll do our best. Oh, yeah.
We have a helpful guide
with that said,
in our email
find
if you
on if the you internet. Want. Nope, PJ. Yep. Whatever you said. What'd you say?
I said we have a helpful guide in our email if you ever get mixed up.
Oh, yeah.
Pronunciation guide or just the word?
Great. It's pinned. We've got it flagged.
Yeah, I have a YouTube channel called Leanna's Library where I sometimes talk about things that are not First Law.
Sometimes.
I mean, I try to work it into every conversation. It's never not relevant. Yeah. That's where you can find me.
Perfect.
Perfect. Cool. Well, with that, again, thank you so much. Next week, we begin we've already begun the Heroes. I'm so sorry to spoil that. We already said it so many times in the podcast, but we begin.
You sit on a throne of lies.
It's true. I do. Before the Battle, which is part one, The Times Through What War. So the first five-ish chapters. So
it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
If you want to follow us on social media, you can do so by, I think Crossland said we're mostly just on Blue Sky at this point, at Words Whiskey Pod. But if you want to get a direct line on me, you can call my cell phone at 910-408-2534. You can also text it. I've checked, found out you cannot fax it, but... You can try
our best attempts.
You can. Yeah.
How old is your audience? You would need a fax number.
You never know.
We got a full spectrum.
We should.
Okay?
We should actually get a fax number. We should just for the hell of it.
See if something comes in.
I should.
And
get
then
a fax.
You can get faxes from your future selves.
Oh, I love that idea.
It'd be a lot of fun,
PJ. Yeah, you're going to have to figure that out. That's on you.
I don't think Kaylin would like me getting a fax machine and setting it up in our basement.
You don't think so?
I don't think the fax machine would like it either.
It's for the family.
Apparently, my basement floods sometimes. Who knew? I guess it'll have to go upstairs.
Welcome to basements.
Yeah, but call or text that number and we'll get it. We'll get your messages.
See, the sovereign pronunciation thing, you see, that was a good time for a call.
It would have been a good time for a call.
It would have been a great time for a call. Yeah. Unfortunately, I think he was listening to our Golden Sun episodes, which were 200 some episodes ago. So that phone number didn't exist then. Damn it. Getting corrected on things 4 years later just stings some deep part of me.
I love it. I love it so much.
I mean, I get that on YouTube when I get comments on videos that are like 4 years old that I'm like, you know, this is an old video, right? Like, you looked at the time when this was posted, right? Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Ugh, pain. But beyond that, if you want to leave us a review, please do it on whatever platform you listen to us on, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, etc. It'd be great. Our idle threat of the week is we'll cast you as Shanks if you don't leave us a 5-star review. And you might not want that job.
Oh, everyone wants to be Shanked.
Yeah. I think you do a great job as Shanked.
Yeah.
Dear listener.
And when you say you mean you plurally, meaning everyone.
Every person that's listening to this thinking about
you, the world.
Not leaving us 5-star.
Shanked is the ambiguous hero within us all. With that, we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.